This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, there's a little two Russian lesbians, right? Tattoo.
Yeah, I think they were sisters, I think, but they were lesbians.
Okay, but they weren't
together lesbians.
Yes, right. I got you. All right, CliffCentral.com. It is just after 7. We're going to get into some important news stories. Leanne Moll's got a handle on some of those, and we'll talk to you if you want to get hold of us. 0797482090. Tomorrow's a holiday, so if you're one of those people who needs a break and you feel like you haven't had enough breaks already, first of all, I have to ask, what is wrong with you? Because we have had plenty. I mean, it's always nice, don't get me wrong. Who doesn't love a holiday?
Yeah, but certain things don't stop. You know, like restaurants, if you work in a restaurant.
Yeah, sure. And I suppose there are, you know, like the police and nurses and people like that have to keep doing what they do. And my love and respect for them just increases when things like public holidays happen. But my God, we've had a lot. This week is a disaster if you're trying to do business.
Last week was.
Next week is. And the week before was. So it's enough already. We've written off April. I hope you've had enough now, because we've got to get to work. We've actually got to do some proper stuff, and just in time for winter. So let's get into some stories. I do not believe this for a second. I saw this headline and I thought it's got to be a hoax. April's at an end already, so it can't be April Fools. But there's no way that Afrikaans has been voted the second sexiest language in the world. Is that possible? Is it a hoax?
It's exactly what I thought. It's a list.
My yes for my fork and more, you were.
Yeah. Oh, Hendrik, I love it when you talk foreign. it's a.
You rock my lekker jachs.
Yeah. It's a list by Big Seven Travel. So I looked them up. They're a travel website with an audience of 1.5 million people. They provide information on everything travel, provide readers with recommendations, holiday inspiration, travel trends. And they've done this poll before. And in 2017, Afrikaans took first place for the sexiest language in the world. Another travel company, Lovin.ie, based in Ireland, also revealed that Afrikaans was the sexiest language in the world. Now, it's very difficult to understand, because if you're thinking of a country like Ireland, they're exposed to the European accents, like Dutch accents, German.
French.
It's very odd. I don't really understand. I'm wondering if Afrikaans people got in on the vote.
Yeah, maybe
somebody Afrikaans saw it.
Because listen, I mean, with all the love in the world, by the way, I'm a fan of Afrikaans. I speak Afrikaans. I understand it. I try to speak it as often as I can. This weekend, I spoke a lot of it in the Free State. It's not a sexy accent, though.
Really. Well, maybe there's this, I don't know.
The people may be sexy. I mean, Afrikaans people generally are not bad looking.
Yeah.
But the language, I think they see good looking people speaking like that and they go, well, it's good looking people, but it's not the accent.
Well, Big Seven Travel explained, Afrikaans is a hugely popular accent with many people across the globe, thanks to their unique tones and Saffa slang.
Really?
So first place this time went to the Kiwi accent from New Zealand.
Oh my God.
Which I don't think is attractive.
That's horrible. That's got to be one of the worst accents in the world. That's worse than Afrikaans accent.
So weird. So
I think the people who did this survey all need their heads read.
Yeah. And it was out of 7,000 languages accents.
I find you really sexy.
So looking at
like
number
50. That's gross, right?
I need to paint my duck.
Yeah. I want to put my duck in you.
No, it doesn't get me going.
50th spot
let me
went
stuck
to.
Stuck my duck in you.
Yeah. 50th went to Croatian.
Really?
Which is considered the least popular
what do you
Slavic
think the sexiest,
accent.
What do you think the sexiest accent is? Not language, accent.
I mentioned yesterday that I quite like the Ghanaian accent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember my mom's nurse saying she was speaking to another sister and they were looking for some piece of equipment. And she said, no, I put it under the sink.
What? Under the sink. Okay, but sexy? No.
No, maybe like, not what sexy.
What
fascinating.
What do you find sexy?
French, definitely.
Yes.
French.
That's the obvious.
But I like a twist on the French accents, like a Cameroon, so someone from Cameroon, someone from Senegal.
You like Senegal?
Oh, don't get me started.
So French, but with a little African spice.
And then locally, it would be a Xhosa accent. Yo, ho, ho.
Oh, really?
Talk to me like you have things popping in your mouth. Yo, with and a yo.
Really? Yes. You like that, huh?
Zulu's just as clicky. Okay.
Mm-mm, it's not the same. Yeah, not the same. Yo, if Hugh Masekela sang the click song instead of Miriam Makeba, we'd have a different outcome.
All right, well, Niska says, it's odd, Gareth. I spent 5 years five months in Los Angeles last year. If you walked into a bar or club, all I needed to do is speak Afrikaans, and I had the attention of every guy. It's odd, but true.
When I was in England, if I spoke Afrikaans, it didn't really impress anyone. But if I spoke Zulu, people went crazy for that. They loved it.
Someone says, sexiest accent, Eddie. It's not language. Yes, I know. That's where we've got to start somewhere. And then Crypto Tryhard says, ach, fuck yo, Garrett. Afrikaans is fucking like a man.
So number one, Kiwi. Number two, South African. Three, Irish. Then Italian. Then Australian. Scottish. French at number seven. Spanish at eight. South USA, so like a drawling Texan accent, is number nine. And 10, Brazilian Portuguese.
Yeah. Look, I don't know. I'd say French has got to be right up at the top there.
Seventh,
That's bullshit.
Yeah, it's just how it flows off the tongue.
Italian's good.
Scottish is ahead of French. Oh, I don't think it's not sexy. It's hilarious.
No, Scottish accents are not sexy at all. Oh, yes, I really love the way you look. No. Oh, you're beautiful. Come over here.
It's not sexy. It's funny.
Who's that character from Austin Powers?
Yeah.
My titties are hurting.
Fat bastard, come on.
That is not sexy at all.
It's like they took this list and they inverted it.
Yeah.
I mean, New Zealand is way by far the worst
accent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I all want to lock this basket off of your tuts.
I instantly just picture yellow teeth as well.
Yeah.
Some unkept bodily
Mr.
hair.
Mr. Schmangle says the people who did that survey must get murdered. My brother is a South African. He lives in South Africa, but when he speaks Afrikaans with his Kiwi accent, women fall at his feet. Rob.
Huh.
Brazilian Portuguese is very sexy, says Matthew.
That's number 10.
Okay.
Now, I find more... Yeah, it would have to be like Spanish.
That's eighth.
Spanish sexy. The way some people speak very... hey,
Kimberindaro
po buenos mercanderos. Ay, ay, ay.
Ay, papi.
Ay, papi. Muy caliente.
I think you guys are more like in the... Like the South American vibe there.
I'm taking my jacket off now.
All right.
This is intense.
But there we go. Good. Good stuff. Happy to hear it. All right, good for Afrikaans accents. That's very nice.
That are nice.
I don't believe it, but that are nice.
Believe it, because it's true.
All right, so a few things that I wanted to bring up this morning, and Leanne has a few others on her agenda. But apparently the dead, if you watched Game of Thrones Episode 3, which I watched last night, I'm not going to do any spoilers, don't worry. But, you know, it's basically this battle between the dead and the living. It's huge. It is an hour and 20 minutes long, and it's one long battle.
Oh, gosh. And it is how exhausting.
No, it's amazing. I watched it 1.5 times.
Jeez.
I couldn't get through the whole thing, but 1.5 times, I loved it. I'm going to say Game of Thrones went through some ups and downs. They've killed off some of my favorite characters, but my God, what a show. This is the best episode yet. Just unbelievable. The suspense is palpable. By the end of it, it feels like you've eaten a good meal. That's how great it is.
Very good.
Awesome show. And if you haven't seen it yet, get to see it ASAP, because you know there's some douchebag out there who's waiting to spoil it for you. Someone who's going to tell you exactly what happened. It's not going to be me, but someone. Apparently the dead will take over Facebook in the next 50 years.
Yep, an analysis suggests that the deceased will soon outnumber the living on Facebook.
Soon?
In the next 50 years.
That's not exactly around the corner, but yeah.
So,
well, there are less people joining Facebook these days than there are people dying.
But also,
Facebook.
When people die, it's you have to get hold of Facebook to ask them to please get rid of the account. And a lot of people don't. They leave it up as a sort of memorial.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd want that. I want it to be pulled down. Feels weird. Have you ever gone on someone who's died's Facebook account?
Yeah.
I haven't. I don't want to do it.
I have.
It freaks me out a little bit.
Especially when someone has just died. You kind of want to see what they said last. It's just a morbid curiosity.
Oh, don't like that.
So even if you look even further, if Facebook were to continue existence into the year 2100, the number of deceased users would be as high as 4.9 billion.
Yeah.
So in one case, they use two scenarios. In one case, in which it is assumed no additional users join as of 2018, Asia's number of deceased users would increase quickly to account for close to 44% of the total by the end of the century, with close to half of the profiles originating from India and Indonesia, combining to become roughly 279 million mortalities by 2100.
Wow.
In the second scenario, it's assumed that Facebook continues to grow at roughly 13% every year until market saturation is achieved. In this case, Africa will dominate the share of departed users, with Nigeria one of the top areas contributing to the number.
Hmm.
So yeah, it's quite a difficult thing to.
How do you get your account or someone else's account shut down?
I would have to look that up. I haven't had to do it yet, thank goodness.
Hmm. Okay, all right. Well, here's some interesting info. The Emperor of Japan is stepping down and letting his son take over.
Okay.
Emperor Akihito will soon abdicate the chrysanthemum throne, becoming the first Japanese monarch in modern history to do so.
Is it because he's getting old?
Yeah, he is old, but he wants his son to take over because he's just over it.
Hours, Emperor Akihito will abdicate the chrysanthemum throne, making way for his 59-year-old son.
God, this guy can't speak. This is on CNN, by the way.
What the hell?
This guy's got like a major problem with this. He has diction problems. He's the least articulate person in television history. Jesus Christ. Did you hear how he said chrysanthemum?
Do it again.
Listen to the chrysanthemum throne.
Hours, Emperor Akihito will abdicate the chrysanthemum throne, making...
Chrysanthemum throne? No!
Chrysanthemum!
It's Emperor Akihito, and he's abdicating the chrysanthemum throne. He's not... Emperor Akihito is abdicating the
chrysanthemum
throne. Listen to this.
Emperor Akihito will abdicate the chrysanthemum throne, making way for his 59-year-old son to become monarch. Akihito has been treated for prostate cancer and has undergone heart surgery and says he is stepping down for health reasons. He will be remembered for connecting public in a way no previous monarch has. Will Ripley joins us now live from Tokyo. So, Will, I guess in terms of their daily lives, how important, how big, how relevant is this royal handover to most Japanese?
What's wrong with this man?
I don't know. He can't speak properly. I think he might be drunk. Who is he? Some dude on CNN.
And he's an anchor.
Well, you know, I've been talking to a lot of people in Japan about this, John. You talk to the older generation who grew up with the imperial family, extraordinarily relevant. Perhaps the younger generation, not so much. But if I give you just a little bit of a walk around here outside the Imperial Palace in Tokyo, which on a normal day is, you know, there's people here. But this is a day where it's raining. I have this umbrella just in case the skies open up. And yet we have crowds gathering hours ahead of the abdication ceremonies, which begin within the next couple of hours. And you see people of all ages, all walks of life, who've come from all over Japan, and some foreign tourists as well, because they want to get a look at the Imperial Palace on this really monumental day. It's the last day of the Heisei era, the era of serene peace. And Emperor Akihito is an extraordinarily iconic figure in this country, a beloved figure in this country, because he was born in a time of Imperial Japan, when Japan was trying to conquer Asia, much in the way that Nazi Germany tried to conquer Europe. And yet, that whole world fell apart at the end of World War II, when the United States bombed the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And Emperor Akihito went from, you know, living inside this palace and being considered the son of a god to being essentially a symbol of the state and a symbol of the people. It was a role that his father, Hirohito, was never fully comfortable with, but Akihito really embraced the role. And he's widely credited with transforming the image of Japan and helping to build up Tokyo from the ashes of World War II to this thriving metropolis that you see that surrounds the Imperial Palace. This is one of the biggest metropolitan areas in the world. And yet, this chunk of land here behind me where all of these abdication ceremonies will be taking place, it was at one point, John, rumored to be worth the entire state of California in terms of real estate at the height of Japan's housing bubble. And now to have the imperial family here, they're going to be doing some very, very ancient ceremonial traditions, things that are mystical, in some ways mysterious, things that will never be seen by the outside world. You can see why, even despite the rain, the crowds continue gathering here to get a look at it.
All right, well, there we go. So
at least we could understand him.
Oh, thank God, that other dude. What's wrong with that guy?
That's hilarious.
Anyway, so that's from CNN. Emperor Akihito abdicating the throne.
So to give you your answer about what do you do if someone you know dies on Facebook, you have the account memorialized. So if you actually search how to report a deceased person on Facebook, you'll see a contact us button. And if you memorialize the account, it means that that the family are allowed to post on the account, but it's not shown to anyone other than the friends of the person.
Oh, okay.
But also, you can designate now while you're alive a legacy contact who will be able to pin a post on your timeline after your death, such as a funeral announcement, etc. And there are instructions with how to do that.
Well, we should all do that right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Make sure that, I mean, because you think about how many people are, you only find out afterwards someone's died, you know, if it's not a very good friend. And then you see suddenly that people are putting their condolences messages up on the wall. And
So, yeah, you go to security and you click on legacy contact.
Listen, it's kind of morbid, but you'd rather be prepared than have this happen to you, right? Someone says here that you have to send a death certificate to the Facebook page, which allows people to close or visit and leave messages.
Mm.
Not an open page anymore. So that's someone agreeing with you. All right. Mm. Some people want to know about other accents. So somebody says, what about a Cuban accent? Well, that's slightly Spanish, but I suppose got a Caribbean flair to it, which makes it exciting as well. I love the Jamaican accent.
Oh, yes. You see, I hadn't thought of those.
And then Czech women's accents are absolutely and absurdly hot.
Okay, yes.
That's according to someone else. But they sound like porn star, all of them.
Yes, for adult entertainment.
Shame, that is such a stereotype. What a shit thing to say.
We're so horrible.
Yeah, I mean, that's awful. We're going to have a psychic join us just now, Clairvoyant Aida. She was such a hit a few weeks ago that when she spoke to us, a lot of people had more questions for her. So we've got a few. I've got a few questions to ask her. Have you thought of a few, Leanne?
Yes, I have.
All right.
I've sent them on.
My questions are the following. Will my eldest child be an astronaut?
Come on.
All right, it's a tricky question. Second question from me, will Jacob Zuma go to jail? And the third question, will Sia find true love?
Mine are so similar.
What are yours?
Well, first, the one isn't. Will I lose 20 to 30 kilograms?
All right.
Should I have had children? Mm-hmm. And will I find love again?
Hmm. Well, let's see. We'll find out what she has to say.
I had to phone my mom to ask what time I was born.
Oh.
Because I don't remember, obviously.
Well, why not? What was wrong with you? Why
I was a little busy trying to breathe.
Quite an important thing. Why weren't you paying attention, you idiot? All right, it's 19 after 7. Coming up, a psychic, some more news stories, and plenty of other good stuff. If you want to get us on 0797482090, you can right now.
Some shocking news now as a tourist in London has found themselves in hot water for slander against a national icon. Now, while on a cruise on the Thames, the backpacker referred to London's iconic clock tower as Big Ben and has been slapped with fines for being sizist and misgendering an object. The clock tower has not been referred to as Ben since 2021, but rather as Clock Self, until a subcommittee has investigated which gender the tower may be, if any. Also, and even more problematic, is the malicious term big as a jab at the tower's size. You may recall, it too was removed from the title in 2021, but then re-added 2 years later with the Big is Beautiful campaign, and then taken off once again in 2026 when it was decreed that no object should be classified as beautiful as it creates unrealistic expectations. We all know this. Now, the tourist apologized, but was again fined for calling their tour vehicle a double-decker bus. When will he, I mean them, learn?
the future's coming. So travel before it's not fun anymore. With Flight Center Youth and Adventure. Trips to London from just 5600.
Love it. Very cool. All right. So some other things we need to talk about today. Where do we begin, Leanne? Sexy face or body? Scientists have finally uncovered what men really want. Now.
Which do you prefer?
See, if a woman has a really beautiful face, then I look at the body afterwards. If she's got a really hideous face, it almost doesn't matter to me what the body looks like. I've got to be honest. I think I'm going to go with face.
Mm-hmm. You'd be right. That's exactly how the research came out.
So I'm not an outlier. I'm in the majority here.
Yeah. Okay. So whether it was a short-term or a long-term relationship, male volunteers were found to prioritize an attractive face over an attractive body. So what they did was they could look at a number of physical traits, which were half of which were facial. So eyes, nose, hair, complexion, and smile. Mm-hmm. The other half were body related: height, muscle, breast size, chest size, waist size, and hip size. Mm-hmm. And then you had to rate them from 0 to 10, depending on what you valued the most. Giving a full 10 score for every trait was impossible, as there were only limited points available to each participant. So like a budget, meaning that they had to compromise in their ratings and prioritize their preferences.
Yeah, I like that.
So yes, the only scenario in which the body trumped the face was when male participants allocated with smaller budget of points were asked to design the perfect partner for a short-term fling. In other words, men with more points to work with still chose an attractive face, even for the short-term relationships.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So face always wins over body.
That's right.
So if you'd rather be gorgeous in the body area, you need to relax, because it's actually all about your face. If you've got a pretty face and you've got an okay body, you'll get away with more than if you've got an okay face and a beautiful body.
And for women, they didn't go into the whole study, but they just mentioned
women don't care really.
Women are less judgmental, according to the evolutionary history of humans.
Well, are they? I mean, I don't know. I think that may be changing. Maybe it used to be that way, but I don't think women are like that anymore. I mean, women can be very superficial.
Yeah, especially I think one of the big things for women is height. That comes up the time on dating websites.
Women do not like a short guy. Hey, short guys, I'm sorry about that.
It's just, it's weird. I mean, even short women don't necessarily want a short guy.
They don't. No one wants short guys. They don't even want them. The short guys don't want to be short guys. It's a bit of a dead end for them, isn't it? All right, so if you're short this morning, just kill yourself. All right, let's move on.
Oh, my God. What have you done?
apparently, the flip phone has made a return. Oh, these things are so lame.
You know why? It's because
I used to have one.
People actually want to tune out. And when you, if you look at a flip phone, if you can try and remember what they look like,
yeah,
they only have a tiny little space for an alert on your screen.
It's got a little micro screen, and then it's got the big screen inside.
Well, no, not even the screen, just the buttons. Think back.
Yeah. Oh my God, those kind of flip phones?
Yes.
This is like the early kinds. All right, so these are like the buttons with the letters on them. Mm. You know, like the those first Nokias, basically.
Yeah.
We used to get Ericssons and Motorolas. Those ones with an aerial. The picture that they've got, that Leanne's just shown me, has got an aerial. It's that old. Wow.
And the reason why people are doing this is because they're tired of actually being constantly connected.
Yeah.
So, you know, and your screen shouts at you all day.
Well, we spoke to this woman yesterday.
Exactly.
Who's an addiction expert. And she
technology
was
addiction.
Yeah, she said that we're all addicted to this stuff. Now, if you can actually break away from your phone for a few days, I envy you. I don't know if I can. I think I might be in trouble. I think a lot of us are addicted to our phones, and a lot of us are using our phones for way too much of the time, and we're using it for stuff that we don't need it to be doing.
So this product designer, Kai-Wei Tang, he spent years designing.
Kai-Wei Tang.
Mm-hmm, you remember him? Yes. He spent years designing smartphones for big companies like Nokia and Motorola.
Mm-hmm.
But he started to feel bothered by a single recurring image, whether it was a restaurant, subway car, or the park, the majority of people he saw were busy staring at their phone, swiping away. The smartphone, he felt, was no longer a neutral device. And he said after 10, he did an experiment where people experienced an initial anxiety when they were taken away, when their phones were taken away from them. Yeah. But he said after 15 to 20 minutes, they start paying attention to the buildings, the clouds, the sky, and their friends. And he found it very encouraging.
All right.
And apparently there is this move away from smartphones. People are starting to buy the old types, the simpler, less addictive phones of the late 1990s and early 2000s.
Huh.
Just with the basic features.
I don't want to go back to those phones. I mean, they really are crap. Most horrible, horrible phones. I remember using them and I didn't like them.
You could only talk,
at the
text.
Time, of course, but at the time they were very, cool and, they were the state-of-the-art thing. But they're awful now compared to what we've got now. Sia, you don't want a flip phone.
Mm-mm. The novelty of those was only that you could walk away from the phone while you're still on the phone. You weren't tethered by a curly cord.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true, because before that we actually had connected phones. Like, you had to be connected to a receiver.
Yeah.
And a wire into the wall.
You couldn't walk very far.
Sia, do you know that we had phones like that once? You've grown up in the totally digital era. You don't know about this stuff.
Once upon a time, I did know that.
I'm going to bring in an old Bakelite rotary phone for you.
I never was able to work that. And no, to be honest, no, I was born and we didn't even have that at home.
I told you about my friend, my Portuguese friend at school, Jennifer Frusto do Mata.
No, you didn't.
She
is that an order at a restaurant?
Yeah.
I would like the Frusto do Mata, but only with the extra tomato.
No cheese.
Do Mata.
Do Mata. All right. Sorry.
Anyway, my mom was one of the first to get a mobile phone. It was a big Motorola flip phone.
You must have been rich.
And yeah, so rich. and Jennifer said to her mom, Mom, I'm so tired of seeing everybody with their mothers have got phones. Why don't you have a phone? And Jennifer Frusto do Mata's mom came to pick us up the one day from school in her yellow Beetle. And before we could get to the car, she opened her door and stood out. And she had the receiver end of a telephone with the curly cord. And the actual box of the phone fell onto the tar. And she pretended she was on it, and then she held it in the air, and she went, Jennifer, telephone!
I love her. I love that woman. I think that's great. Why do I love it when parents embarrass their kids so much? Because I had that with my parents.
Yeah, we all had it to a certain degree.
I swear my parents used to go out of their way to embarrass me.
Horror.
I was fine with it. Eventually, it gives you a thick skin. You develop a I-don't-care-what-people-think attitude. I think parents should be forced to make their kids embarrassed every week.
That's the quote of the day.
But some most parents don't need to even try.
Mothers should arrive to pick up their kids with their tits out. Fathers should arrive with like loud, unpopular music playing. They should come in and run up to other kids and hug them and say, "I'm so glad to see you." Like, make the child uncomfortable.
It's really not easy to embarrass a teenager. I mean, it's really not...
Not hard.
It's not hard, yeah. Just breathing.
Yeah. And most parents don't have to do much to be embarrassing.
All right, well, we're talking about parents. Do you want a dad joke?
Uh-oh.
Yes.
My wife just gave birth today, and after thanking the doctor, I pulled him aside and sheepishly asked, "How soon do you think we'll be able to have sex?" He winked at me and said, "I'm off duty in 10 minutes. Meet me in the car park." All right. Okay, are you ready for some psychic stuff? Is that what you want to do right now? Is that what you feel like, Leanne Mole?
What
I'm trying to do
that?
UFO noises.
Oh. Why didn't you just ask? I can find you some.
Can you please do some UFO noises?
Well, I can't make them myself, but I can find you like some.
Okay, maybe you can find some.
I was wondering where...
You totally killed it.
Try it again. Let's try again.
Here we go. This is what we need.
Oh, there we go. Thank you.
Not exactly UFO noises, but there we are. All right.
Something like a choking canary.
You remember we spoke to clairvoyant Aida a few weeks ago, and she was such a hit that she told Gord he was going to expand, which I took to mean that he's going to get fatter. That wasn't what she meant.
The verdict is out.
She said Sia should be careful around motorbikes, and as a result, Sia's paranoid as all hell.
Oh my word. Ben's going to drive him over in the parking lot with his bike.
That's exactly what we've been saying.
Yeah, we thought it would only be fair to see what lies ahead for the rest of the team and the country overall. So we have psychic Sarah Jane Brown, who's joining us via Skype for a live reading this morning. So, Sarah Jane, you've been given mine and Leanne's date and time and place of birth, relationship status, etc. You don't know which is which, but you're going to answer some of our questions now about us. Good morning, first of all, and welcome.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, yes.
Am I coming? Okay, that's perfect. Look, first of all, before we go any further, I would like to say that short men are absolutely gorgeous. So I think your comment earlier, short men, I'm 5'10", and they make the best lovers.
Oh, very good. All right, well, if you give it, you know, saying that as a psychic and as a person in the physical realm, I'm going to believe you.
Yeah, I'm saying it for both, yes.
Are you currently stopped on the side of the highway?
Me? No.
Oh,
why?
It sounds like there are cars whizzing past you.
Stop trying to be a psychic, Gareth.
Oh, no. I just moved to the beachfront of Cult Bay in Cape Town. And the main road is going backwards and forwards.
It's my old hood.
There are cars.
Oh, well, I sense there are cars in your future.
Okay. I hope so. I need one.
All right. So, Sarah Jane, let's start off with Leanne Moll. She's sitting here looking resplendent and buxom in all of her glory. She wants to know a couple of things about herself, and maybe you can give us a general reading after that. But Leanne wants to know, first of all...
So my questions are, will I lose 20 to 30 kilograms? Because God knows I need to.
Okay. If you are putting on a lot of weight, it usually means you're earning too much money and you're eating too much food. Okay. So you've got to get your mindset into the right place to lose weight. It's not just about the food that you eat. It's also about how you think and how you act. You've got to cut out the soda drinks. You've got to cut out the fast food and maybe intake more sugar. Eat lots of chocolate. But most definitely, you're going to lose the weight. Looking at your age, it's usually the time of life when you start to put on that little bit of weight and the body starts to change a little bit. So without doing a reading, without a doubt you're going to be losing the weight. You've already started wanting to do it. Now you've just got to put it into action.
Brilliant stuff. I love to hear that. Thank
you. I think you're just giving her good news. I don't think you know her very well. All right. How about should she have had children? It's too late for Leanne. The factory's closed, but should she have had children?
I don't know if the factory's closed, looking at her age. I mean, there's still a chance that she can walk out, fall in love, and have a baby, because I had a baby at 42. But I would say that there is a soul that would like her to be a mother. So whether that's somebody she's going to meet that's already got children, or whether that's she's going to adopt a child, I mean, for example, in Cape Town, there's a charity called Naomi's Joy, and they are always looking for people which can take on babies and adopt them. They've just got so many which are available. So I still think she's going to become a mother. I did see in the cards that she's focusing very much, very much.
Sorry, that was just Leanne's child screaming.
I already fetched one from the place you mentioned.
No, she ran over there as soon as you mentioned it, and she's got one already.
No, but I do think that there is a soul that would like you to be a mother, and I think it's something that you will probably explore down the line. There's no excuse, just because you can't give birth to a child yourself, that you're not going to have a child. So I think you're going to become a mother.
Wow. I'm going to be a skinny mum.
So far, this sounds great for you, Leanne. All right, let's get to the really, really tough question here. Will she ever find love again, Leanne Moll? Will you ever find love again?
Well, you know, this is the one question that I get asked. Am I ever going to fall in love? Of course you're going to fall in love again. We don't just get one soulmate. We get many soulmates. And I can see from the questions that you ask that you are now getting ready for the next part of your life. So you will find over the next 3 months, things are going to start changing a little bit. And probably out of the blue, you're going to walk into someone and he's going to just make you the happiest person that you've ever been.
That is just amazing to hear.
You've been focusing very you've been focusing very much on your career. Now you've got to get it into balance, and now the love is going to come, and it's probably going to be the greatest love of your life.
Oh my God.
Fantastic.
What exciting news. Oh. So all three, she's got great answers on all Happy three days. Of these questions. Lucky Leanne Moll. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
All right, so tell us just generally what else you see. I mean, let's just turn it to the national for a second. I've got a question about will Jacob Zuma go to jail? A lot of people are asking that. The elections are next week. What do you see happening there? How does this affect all of us, and what's the general energy around that?
Well, the general energy around the elections, I cannot stop getting this picture out of my mind that South Africa is going to have this huge celebration, very much like what happened with Trump when all the people were hiding and they couldn't tell that his was the popular vote and Clinton was coming through. I've got a feeling that South Africa is going to have a huge shock. I mean, just imagine if a new party comes along, the corrupt politicians fall away and South Africa has something to celebrate, because we all seem to live in this dark cloud and everything's going to go wrong, and it's not. Everything's going to go absolutely fantastic. And there's one thing I would like to say, and that is that Julius Malema is going to have something happen to him which is going to change him. He is too intelligent. He should not be sitting with all those brain cells putting it into racism and threats of killing people. So he is going to have an experience like a near-death experience, something that's really going to shake him up, and I guarantee he is going to be a very different person, because we need a good leader like him, but not with the mindset that he's got now. And it almost feels like Mandela is breathing down his neck saying, what are you doing? God does not give people intelligence and then give it to them to do wrong things with. He needs to speak for all of South Africans, because I believe we do not have black, white, colored, Indian, and I hate it when you have to fill out that form and tick which race group you are. We are South Africans. There is a new breed of person called a South African that is all the race groups. So Julius Malema is definitely going to have something happening to him. Jacob Zuma will probably try and skip the country. If he doesn't skip the country like a chicken and run really fast, then I would say that he's going to be brought to accountability. It might take a year or two, but in this, where we are in life at the moment, you can't get away with doing bad stuff. It's an absolute impossibility.
So just tell me, you said something will happen to Julius Malema. What are you talking about?
Well, Julius is very, very intelligent. And when I saw him doing the State of the Nation address about 2 years ago, he brought tears to my eyes because he was so passionate about defending the Constitution. Now, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, you could have got away with being a bad person, being in politics, or I'm not saying a bad person, but the way that he speaks is so much hate, and he's capitalizing on the fact that that gets that sensational. It's not sensational. It's very old news. Racism does not belong in our century. It's like so last century. So I've seen it time and time again. If you are a bad person, if you've been blessed with the intelligence that he has, and you are using it for the wrong reasons, karma comes along and something happens. And I've had this for a long time now, this feeling. Something is going to happen to Julius and he's going to change. I mean, could you imagine if Julius spoke for South Africans and he was out on the world stage with the new Prime Minister of New Zealand and Canada, and he was standing up for the environment? He's got a far, far bigger calling than the one that he's trying to do right now. He is meant to be far larger than he actually is, but he's doing it all the wrong way, and karma and life is going to trip him up. Mark my words, you will get back to me in the future and you will say you are absolutely right. Julius can't carry on like this.
All right, so he's almost being a little self-destructive. Now, what about our business here, cliffcentral.com, and it's obviously a place a lot of people come to for information and entertainment and all kinds of other things. What do we have to look forward to? We're turning five tomorrow as a business, and I think for a lot of people it's been a really exciting journey, certainly for all of us on the team and for all of our listeners it has. What do you see in the future for us?
Well, I'm really pleased that you asked that, because I've got the same feeling about Cliff Central that I did about Julius becoming a bigger leader than he actually is. And I think you're going to go out there into the world stage. I think it's no longer going to be just South African. It's going to be international. I think it's really important that people that have opinions are out there speaking up for people. I mean, at the moment, just for example, the environment, we've got that little Dickie song which has come out called The Earth Song, mm-hmm. which is all about loving the earth. And And I feel that you have a very strong voice. You're intelligent. You're good looking. You have an opinion about things. And I think you are going to grow bigger than you actually thought. So you need to realize that it's not just going to be South Africa. You have a place on the international stage, and you need to carry on pushing forward.
Mm. All right. I'll take your word for it. Yeah. Sounds nice.
I don't know about the good-looking part, but, you know.
The rest I'll take. All right. Two questions from my side that we need to get to. First of all, will Sia find true love?
Sia will find true love. Oh, my God. How old is Sia now?
He's a baby. He's all of 24.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, you're going to kiss a lot of frogs before you find your princess. Oh. Of course you're going to find true love. As I said to you, that's the one thing that everybody asked. But at the moment, I've got a feeling that he's also focusing on business. The next person that he meets might be the party person that he goes around with. I would say probably around 30, he'll find that real person, because he's got a little bit of evolving to do in his mind. Learn a bit more about karma, learn more how the universe works. Just remember that if you're on an online dating site or if you're meeting someone, it's really important that that person has worked through their problems and their issues, because otherwise you end up fighting because they've got all these problems inside themselves. So the first thing that you can do is, if the person understands karma, if they understand star signs, if they understand organic food, you need to look for that sort of person so that they're very evolved. You don't want to go for someone who only likes music, fancy cell phones and cars. So definitely he'll find love.
Okay, but he needs to dig a bit deeper.
Yes.
And is there any particular place I should be looking in? You know, the grocery store, the law
the
firm.
Nightclub.
You don't have to look. This person's already looking for you. You just have to, the best advice I can give you is have the courage to walk through doors when they're open. So if there's something you've been invited to and you really don't want to go, force yourself to go, because that is where you'll meet the person. And it will be out of the blue. You'll lock eyes and you'll just realize that this person is meant for you. And another thing is, don't go sleeping with a whole load of women. It's really bad. Man. It's really bad energy. You need to keep yourself to yourself. Know who you are. Get to know yourself first, so that when you attract the other person, it's an absolute perfect match.
Oh, tell me about it. I know about that bad energy sleeping with women.
All right, so let's talk about something else for a second, because, you know, a lot of people didn't read that Trump would be president of the U.S. or that the U.K. would Brexit, or that lots of other things that have happened in the past, that they would happen. And I'm talking about economists and scientists and people who are studying polls. Maybe the psychics even have a better reading on this than anyone else. What happened with Notre Dame the other day? What do you take from that symbolically?
Symbolically, well, look, this sounds a little bit wacky, but some of your listeners will understand exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah. Word on the street is there's this very strong ET connection that's coming. And an ET connection is when you start having your messages. So, for example, a lot of people understand that if you have a feather on your path, that's your angel speaking to you. When Notre Dame went up, I sat there and I looked at it and I thought, well, there we go. The world is changing. The signs are coming. You don't need a priest to talk to God. You can get up in the morning and you can talk, whoever you believe in, whether it's a goddess, whether it's God, whether it's Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker. But definitely that was a huge, huge sign with Notre Dame going off. And what was interesting was the results that came out on the internet, where everybody was so upset that the billionaires were giving money to Notre Dame, yet there's starving people in the world. And it's those sorts of things which are now going to happen, because the world is evolving into a new earth with a higher vibration, and it's got a very strong love energy attached to it. So that is where the world's going. You can't be a bad person anymore, and you have to look out for the signs and symbols around you that will guide you, to let you know that angels or the ETs or whoever you want to call it are guiding you in the right direction.
All righty. Well, listen, I'm afraid that's all we got time for this morning. But Sarah Jane, pleasure to speak to you, and thank you for filling us in. Over 1,000 readings, and when working on a large scale, you get to see everyone is coming forward with the same problems and issues. She gets to see what's happening spiritually in a global sense. We thought we'd check in with her just ahead of our 5th birthday. Coming up next, our own version of blind history. It's a thing that we put together with Anthony Medera from Taylor Blinds, where we basically get into the character and the personality and the story of one great person from history. And they don't always have to be good people, but today's, I think, was. Queen Elizabeth I. That's coming up next in Blind History on the Way.
Now, this is concerning. There's been an alarming rise in the recreational abuse of bananas recently. Now, you'll recall in the mid-2020s, it was revealed that bananas contain potentially dangerous and possibly addictive quantities of the chemical serotonin. Mexico, of course, was one of the last countries to outlaw the production and sale of this alleged gateway fruit. But as recently as 2027, our correspondent on the ground found it very easy to get a hold of. Over to you, Dave.
Ah, thank you, Tim. As you can see, you can just buy these bananas at the side of the road.
Oh, wow.
It's all out in the open. Just shocking.
Unbelievable. On the line, Pam Ellis, concerned parent and founder of Yellow Alert. Pam, do you believe that we have underestimated the threat?
That's right, Tim. Kids are going to Tijuana on these so-called banana trips without fully understanding the consequences,
right.
The risks. When you eat bananas, mm-hmm. You're playing with fire.
It's so scary. Relations between the U.S. and Mexico are strained enough as it is, and we'll be following this developing story closely. Keep an eye on your kids.
The future's coming, so travel before it's not fun anymore with Flight Center Youth and Adventure. Trips to Mexico for less than $14,999.
The face of the imperious queen was covered in white makeup, pockmarked by the smallpox that she'd contracted earlier in life. At age 70, she appeared ghostly and severe, with only a few teeth left in her mouth so that her speech was difficult to understand. Her extravagant wigs, collars, ruffs, and the great jewels in her hair gave the impression of a grand old woman who could tell that the end was near. But she had survived. She had survived her father. She had survived her sister and her brother, and numerous other plots on her life. She was never meant to be queen, and yet here she was. And by the end of her reign, they called her Gloriana, the personification of Britannia, the fairy queen, the first Elizabeth, the one who brought on the Elizabethan age. So, Queen Elizabeth I, and we're currently living in the reign of Queen Elizabeth II, and this Elizabeth I was unbelievable. Punched huge holes in history. I'm with Anthony Medera. You're listening to Blind History. What do you think of her?
I love her. Incredible story. Obviously, it skipped a few. Henry VIII's charisma and all that he had, the good parts of him, skipped the son,
yeah,
and Edward, and skipped Mary,
well,
Mary the First.
Yeah, Mary was probably quite a poisonous person.
And in Elizabeth, but it didn't skip Elizabeth. And if you think about it, I mean, she was incredible. And also during Mary's volatile tenure, she fitted in. She didn't push the buttons. She went to mass, although she was a Protestant like her dad. She played the game politically.
Yeah, she tried very, very much to fit in where she realized she didn't have the power to do anything else.
So I loved her, Gareth. One of the best monarchs.
Yeah, she was also just an extraordinarily powerful woman at a time where there weren't a lot of women who were powerful. And if they were, they had to shut up about it.
Yeah, exactly.
She got to live. She got to be the person she wanted to be, and she didn't need any man to make her whole.
And very strategic. You know, she didn't want the complication of a husband, mm-hmm. because if it came from her court, then, you know, what impression does it do in the court? Jealousy, etc. And she didn't want to get a husband from some other country, because then what does it mean? She's going to put her country under threat. So she was very strategic. She loved England. She was really all for the kingdom.
Well, she comes from the House of Tudor, and you've already mentioned her father. She inherited his appearance in that she had the red hair, and she was tall, and she was quite statuesque, and in her youth she was quite beautiful too. But she was 2.5 when her mother had her head cut off. Remember, Henry VIII, her father, had married Anne Boleyn, her mother, because she'd been this beautiful woman in court. He divorced his wife, Catherine of Aragon, against the wishes of the Catholic Church, and actually separated from the Catholic Church, creating the Anglican Church, just so he could be with Elizabeth's mother, Anne Boleyn, who then married him, and their marriage lasted for a very short time, and she eventually lost her head, and poor little Elizabeth, 2.5 years old, without a mum, and with a dad who then was regretting his decision to marry her mother, and regretting her being in existence. So she was the first fruit of the Anglican tree, but she was also declared illegitimate in her first 3 years. She was a symbol of great hatred to Catholics because she was the cause of a break between the Mother Church and the father of of the nation, the king. And from there on, her life really was very complicated. So she had to play a game of survivor at every step of the way from there on in.
She did that very well. She was very strict on the Anglican side, and mass was disallowed. So a lot of the strong, loud-mouthed Catholics went into exile. But continuously for many, many years, they said she was illegitimate, and they kept pushing Mary, Queen of Scots. Finally, Elizabeth had to behead her, but you could see she fought very hard not to.
Yeah, well, let's save that, because that's a grisly story
But to your point, she's a survivor. She's a genuinely survivor. There was a lot going on in right throughout her career. And she also went to battle, and she won a fierce battle, which is very, very important against the Spanish. And that really put her into folklore. That really just elevated her to be one of the great monarchs of English history.
We know a lot about her because there were a lot of great authors and playwrights who lived in her time. Shakespeare and Marlowe are the most important here. And we have a lot of stories that came out of her court. I mean, she was quite mischievous. She was playful. She was also intensely jealous of attention, a lot like her father. So there was a lot of ego there too. I remember that one of the stories that people would tell is that all the women in her court were required to wear just black and white, but she could wear all the colors and all the jewels. So she was very easily put out if any of them got more attention than her from any of the men in court. And she used to constantly say, "I'm married to all of you," to her parliament and to her ministers. And she would flirt with them. And then if they got too flirty in return, she'd smack them down again. So it was a power play the whole time. And she used her femininity and her wiliness, and she was supremely intelligent too, to just keep people doing the maximum for her without her having to do anything for them in return. She did have men in her life, and she did consider marriage a number of times. She considered marrying the French Duc d'Anjou. She considered marrying a Spanish prince. She considered marrying some Germans. But none of them really did it for her, and she decided eventually to marry England. And when the Duc d'Anjou, who was a last real serious contender for marriage, left on a boat down the Thames, she's reported to have said, "There, now you have me all to yourself," and turned to face England. I mean, it's a beautiful story. We don't know if it's true.
Look, do we believe she was the virgin that everybody says she was?
Well, there's a lot of speculation about that. She had two serious favorites in court. The first was the Earl of Leicester, who was a real friend to her and whom she admired right to the end. And she's supposed to have mourned him for a very long time after he died. He cared for her. He looked after her. He protected her from actual assassination attempts. He went to war for her. He did everything he could to win her over, but she always kept him slightly at an arm's length. So if the mythology is to be believed, she never really gave in to him from a passionate, loving point of view. And she probably was like that because she never knew who she could trust. She never really had a mum. She viewed her dad as this terrifying, megalomaniac god emperor, who she admired tremendously and had great respect for, but she was never loved by him. She couldn't trust her own brother and sister, both of whom in various ways tried to have her put to death. So maybe she just never trusted anyone enough to let them that close to her. And her second admirer or favorite was the Earl of Essex, who was a much younger man. And she was quite infatuated with him. And she would kiss him in court and things like that. But she never was alone with him at night.
But he was quite impetuous.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she eventually had to have him beheaded.
Mm. But also that was possibly because he was trying to rise up against her in some way.
No, in very obvious ways. He actually caused a civil disobedience and led troops to the palace to kill her minister Burley.
Sure.
But so she said, "No, thank you, not anymore," and off with his head.
But he also, what happened, it was quite difficult to control him and old Essex. And what he did was, he stormed into her chambers, and, you know, nobody was allowed to see her except her chambermaids.
Well, without her makeup and her dress.
Yeah, exactly. The point is, it took her 4 hours to get ready in the mornings. So,
and especially when Essex was around, that was when she was already in her 60s. Mm. So she was a much older woman by that stage.
And what she had done already from the early years is she put this white lead is a name for it, that used to put on her face to give her face that allure of being pure and white, and different types of chemicals on her lips to keep them red. These, they sucked all the moisture out of you, and it really made you gray and haggard quicker than normal.
It was poisonous.
Yeah, it was poisonous. And because he didn't really care, you know, too much about rules, he stormed into her chambers before she'd actually got dressed, her chambermaids, and he saw her. And he obviously cucked himself. That's not what's written. But
she must have been frightening.
Yeah, so he
The portraits of her, which aren't very flattering, and the Tudors were quite famous for saying, paint me as I am.
Mm.
And there are portraits of hers that have been changed subsequent to her death by people who wanted to propagandize her image. But there are a few paintings that survive that are really not flattering. Mm.
Well, he said, his exact words, secretly, but she found out that she looked like a crooked carcass.
Mm.
So,
Most of these cosmetics did do damage to her skin. Cerussa was corrosive. These women who used it about their faces, says a source, do quickly become withered and gray-headed, because this doth so mightily dry up the natural moisture of the flesh, to your point. You mentioned Mary Queen of Scots earlier, and she had this kind of sibling rivalry with Mary Queen of Scots. Mary Queen of Scots had married the French king, and so she had been Queen of France, and then she had married the Scottish king and had been Queen of Scotland. She produced with the Scottish king a son, called James, who would eventually become Elizabeth's heir. But Elizabeth never spoke of the succession and refused to countenance her own death. So she would never really speak to James. But she met with Mary once, and they had apparently a very loud and fractious conversation. Mary told Elizabeth she was her superior, and Elizabeth said, "You don't know what you're talking about." She was already Elizabeth's captive at the time. And she had to make this really difficult call of executing Mary, who was the center of so much opposition to her. And she had a guy called Walsingham in her court who was like her spy master. And Walsingham had warned her that Mary, Queen of Scots, was the lightning rod for people who didn't like Elizabeth. And so instead of actually signing the death warrant publicly, she signed it and told one of her servants to just keep it. And the servant went and gave it to the council. And the council then realized that what she was trying to do was to get them to sign the death warrants, that she wouldn't personally have to be blamed, because she was killing her cousin. Mm. And there'd been enough beheadings in her time. And Mary Queen of Scots' beheading was horrible because the executioner missed and hit the back of her head first and then had to take a second stroke.
Oh, sure, that's horrible.
Yeah, and cut the neck. And then there was still a bit of gristle, so he had to go a third time. And the head rolled off the scaffold, and he picked it up, not knowing she wore a wig. And the wig remained in his hand, and this withered little head rolled down with very short gray hair, and the mythology of Mary Queen of Scots was shattered in that moment. Horrible story. One of the ugliest executions in English history.
The big thing with all these Catholics that were exiled was that she was Catholic, staunch Catholic, and they believed she was a rightful heir. She was actually Henry's sister's daughter.
Yes, that's right.
So there was definitely lineage there.
Yeah.
So a lot of the battles often in those times was from a religious background.
Well, it's interesting that there's nobody alive today who can claim to be descended from King Henry VIII, certainly not legitimately, because none of his children had children. So the Tudor line effectively died out with Elizabeth I. And all subsequent monarchs and all other people who claim descent from the Tudors either have to claim illegitimate descent, because Henry is supposed to have had some illegitimate children, although that's also conjectural. And if not them, through the Stuarts, which was Mary, Queen of Scots. Mm. So the current queen and anyone else who can claim descent from Henry VII, Henry VIII's father, has to claim it through Mary, Queen of Scots, or Margaret, her mother's younger sister, Mary, who was married to the Duke of Suffolk.
And Elizabeth, she never spoke about her mom, but that was, it seemed to have been politically driven, or because her dad, Henry VIII, had really painted quite a dark picture of her being a whore, and that was the reason for the divorce and the beheading, etc. But she wore a locket with a picture of her mom, and she carried that around with her. So obviously her mom really meant something to her, but she never outwardly displayed it. She outwardly showed respect for her father and what had he done, exactly what you said earlier. She admired him.
Well, she's supposed to have made that very famous speech at the beachhead after the Armada was defeated, or just before the Armada, and it was likely that the Spanish would land and the Duke of Parma was going to engage in battle against her while Sir Francis Drake was fighting the Spanish Armada in the Channel, and which he'd roundly defeated subsequent to this. But she made this famous speech, which they quote verbatim. "My loving people, we have been persuaded by some that are careful of our safety to take heed how we commit ourselves to armed multitudes for fear of treachery. But I assure you, I do not desire to live to distrust my faithful and loving people. I know I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England too, and think foul scorn that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of my realm." And apparently after that, there wasn't a man in England who wouldn't fight for her.
Yeah, that was incredible. That was a big turning point. But you know that the Spanish basically got every ship that could float and sent that across. You know, that looked ominous for England. It really looked ominous. The chances of the Spanish overthrowing them was very, very real. Obviously, Francis Drake and Sir John Hawkins. Yeah. They were just phenomenal.
Had smaller ships, so they were much faster.
Yeah.
The Spanish had these huge galleons.
And with deeper drafts, which didn't help them, especially when you start having to navigate in through the channel, coming into to the shallower areas.
Wasn't that also the beginning, really, of English naval supremacy?
I think it definitely was. Because at that, previous to that, it was definitely out of Europe. And that really put her as the greatest monarch.
So to round off Elizabeth's story, she died at 70 years old. She had an enormously long reign, 44 years, which brought massive stability to England. She was succeeded by her second cousin, James I of England, the 6th of Scotland, whose mother was Mary, Queen of Scots, in a twist of irony. And that was the end of the House of Tudor. But when she died, she was buried on top of, her coffin was put on top of her sister Mary's coffin.
I think she asked for that.
In the same vault, the same tomb, and you can go and see her marble effigy in Westminster Abbey today. Thanks for listening to this episode of Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters.
This is CliffCentral.com.